Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the Castorbis podcast with a K, available on castorbis.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
Yes, we're back. James McLean is here. Hello, James.
I am. You mentioned me first.
Yes. Brian Terranova's here.
No, don't mention him. It's good. We're all
okay.
Good now.
And I'm here, fine. Christian Crawley. Oh, he's fine, he says. He's on one of those transatlantic delays we used to get on the telephone.
No, I was fine with not being mentioned. Yeah.
Ah, right. Okay.
Yeah, I know my place.
Indeed. And it's the Castorbis podcast with a K, and we're here to talk about unicorns. And fairies. And rainbows.
Yeah. Okay.
Of course we're not.
Yeah.
So, this week, we're going to go through a lot of newsy type stuff this week. Because there is a lot of things have kind of come along. And especially today, there's been a couple of things today. And there's one in particular that I want to speak about later on, which isn't... Is it? Yes, we did add it to our show notes at the end. First of all, Stephen Moffat's been upsetting people. Again, by kind of telling us that we shouldn't be calling the Doctor by his nth title because the Doctor doesn't do that. Now, he was speaking to SFX magazine. I'm just going to throw this continuity grenade. Oh, I really want to do the Scottish accent.
Don't.
Okay. I'm just going to throw this continuity grenade back at Doctor Who fans and say, you are all wrong. He has never called himself the anything Doctor in the show.
Except in Time of the Doctor, when
well, before we
Stephen
get to
Moffat
that,
wrote it himself.
Before we get to that, was anyone actually saying he did call himself the Doctor in the show?
Yeah, I think that's, that was my quandary on this article. It seems to be based on an attack on something which I've never heard anyone say.
Yeah.
Really?
It was just a way to reference which Doctor you were referring to when you were speaking about the Doctors.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So do you want to carry on before I give my opinion? Because I don't know if you... Are you
Well, I was going to go through the various examples.
Yeah, please,
okay,
yeah.
So in The Five Doctors, the First Doctor asks the Fifth Doctor which regeneration he is. He says, Fourth. Goodness, so there are five of me now, he continues. There's also there's the Two Doctors. No, there's the Three Doctors, where the Gallifreyans refer to, the Time Lords refer to the Second Doctor as, hey, get this, the Second Doctor. We've also had a nice selection of messages from one of our dear listener on this very subject, who has kindly emailed Brian and I with a list of these. Paul Cheeseman, thank you. Time of the Doctor. Well, number 10 once regenerated and kept the same face, which is maybe what you were alluding to, James. Then we've got the Ultimate Foe. There is some evil in all of us, Doctor, even you, says the Master. The Valiard is an amalgamation of the darker sides of your nature, somewhere between your 12th and final incarnation. Then we've got the TV movie at the beginning where the Doctor says it was towards the end of my 7th life. Or something like that. When the Master was finally put on trial, etc., etc. James.
Yeah, I think everyone's getting a bit confused here as to what's going on. I don't think this is trolling. I think it's obvious. I think you could say the article, it was there to make the article interesting a bit, but I think this is actually quite personal. I still think this is to do with the fact that he had to fiddle the numbers in the last series to make his story work. And he is very sensitive to the fact that people have been constantly asking, questioning, you know, who's the 11th, who's the 12th. Even in the comments to the article, there's a person who says, and quite legitimately, as you have just said, that in the one with the James Corden,
the lodger,
yes, where he sort of says
he's the 11th, doesn't he?
He's the 11th, and so well, yeah, arguably within the show, he is still the 11th Doctor, on the grounds that at that point, the War Doctor to him wasn't a Doctor, so you could still argue that. That is sort of right, couldn't you? No, you couldn't, can you? Because he's counting the, because he counts the post-regeneration one as well, doesn't he? The, what's wrong with my head today? I can't remember Journey's End.
Right.
Heart Meta Doctor as well. He's counted. So I guess I think basically what Moffat is, I think he's agitated at the fact that people keep saying, you know, that he's played with the numbers, and so he's sensitive to this whole numbers thing, and he keeps trying to justify the fact that numbers doesn't matter, ergo what he's done doesn't matter. I think that is the crux of what he's trying to say. The Fourth Doctor is the Fourth Doctor because we call him the Fourth Doctor. It doesn't mean we have to focus on the fact, is he the Fourth? In the same way we have to focus, is Eccleston the Ninth or is the War Doctor the Ninth? It doesn't matter. It's what he's trying to say because he's fudged the numbers up. And he constantly seems to keep coming back to this whole idea that there's not a problem here. Shut up. And there isn't really a problem, but I think he's more oversensitive to it than the fans
I think he's
are.
Made it more than it is by bringing the Doctor's life cycle to an end.
Yes.
As you know, obviously it didn't end, but you know what I mean. If he just left it at the War Doctor, he'd perhaps have got away with it. But because he's decided to take something that really should have been left for a different showrunner in the natural order of things, he's made it worse for himself.
Yes, and I think that's what this is all about. I think it's him, as a fan, justifying his legitimacy in what he's done to other fans. I don't think it's about trolling any more than a fan who wants to sort of stake their point knowing that it's going to be controversial is trolling, but I don't think he's doing it to be promotional. I think this is just him.
You know, even all goes down to he had two doctors to do the Time War story with. He didn't have to create a new one, and if he didn't create the new one, he wouldn't have to be doing all of this backpedaling to try and make his idea seem okay. You know, I mean, he could have easily just gone with McGann and the world would have been fine.
Well, it's all retconned, isn't it? That's the problem, is that, I mean, from the stuff that we've been talking about, what we've been told of late, it seems very clear that the War Doctor was intended to be Eccleston. And then it transpired that Eccleston refused the role, so he moved over to Hurt. In which case, he sort of everything from there on, including maybe even Time of the Doctor to the point of the 13th regeneration, suddenly becomes a bit of a fudge that he's done earlier. And then sort of, so when people say, well, he says he's the 11th Doctor in the Lodger, he was the 11th Doctor then, because it is all retconned. So I don't think he's really got any arguments over this. He's created the mess which the fans are responding to.
Well, he's retconned his own era. He's not retconned the rest of the show. Yes. He's retconned his own era. It's getting, and I know we're in a completely different time, but it's getting into Attack of the Cybermen territory in the 1980s. And a lot of people were upset with the 80s Doctor Who because there was so much looking back. And you've got Attack of the Cybermen with its going back to Telos and all that nonsense and retconning the Cybermen look and a couple of other details.
Do you think it was right? I mean, let's do a Philip here and actually go pro Moffat on this and say,
okay.
Do you think there was a good argument for the fact it being the 50th year that he tried to fudge the numbers so he could introduce a sort of new era to Doctor Who within the 50th year? Or do you think this was a little about the fact that he probably knew that this would be his last attempt to do a regeneration because he wouldn't be going on for another 3 years? It would be unlikely with Capaldi, so he wanted to do this big thing himself. Do you think it's a bit of both?
I don't think that. I mean he got to work, how many doctors did he get to work with? How many regenerations did he do?
Well, he's worked with three, hasn't he? Four.
McGann.
Well, he's worked five. With all the new series plus McGann.
Hurt.
And Smith.
And Davison.
And Capaldi. Just last year.
All right. Oh, yeah.
There's five doctors last year. Of those five doctors, how many regenerations was there? There's McGann's regeneration, there was Hurt's regeneration, there was Smith's regeneration. He's getting a bit greedy. So
I think this whole Moff thinks he owns the show thing is quite evident, and I think that's all it comes down to is that he wanted to be the one to solve that issue, and it happened earlier than maybe he wanted it to, but he still had to control it.
Do you think this is a question again of whether there's a more pros to cons of fans being showrunner? Because I think a lot of fans in his position, to be fair to him, would probably want to do the 13th, you know, Doctor. You know, people, it's easy to sort of say, you know, he's being so arrogant taking over, but a lot of fans would do that, wouldn't they? Because they love the show. He loves the show. It's not him being a sort of a megalomaniac producer.
Well, yeah, it's
him being
a
megalomaniac
toy, though,
fan.
Is it either? It's not a toy.
No.
They're not toys, not. Doc. Devil Storms, they're not toys, Doctor. You know?
You know, I was just talking about this over the weekend, and it made me realize that going back to Let's Kill Hitler and making River Song be whatever kind of Time Lord version type person she may be, because we know she can't be a full Time Lord. I'll go into that in more detail if we need to. But anyway, what was the point of her giving the Doctor all her regenerations if you weren't going to use that to solve the regeneration issue? You know, what was the point? There was no point to actually even telling that story. There was no point to those events. You know, so he already was kind of laying the seeds there, you know, planting the groundwork. But it seems you go back through his era now with things that he retconned within his own writing, certainly in the 50th alone, and a lot of stuff just doesn't work or make sense anymore.
Do you think there's an argument then? Let's throw another question on this, because I'm trying to find ways, because we've obviously been criticized a few times for being far too negative. And I think, well, can't help it. You know, if someone throws a load of chips onto your plate, you've got to eat them. Negative chips, that is. Is there an argument that Doctor Who should become less arc or history intensive? I mean, I know a lot of fans love it. We all love it to a certain degree. But with it being so big and being that, the changes can become so retroactive, and would it be better if it was a little more forward thinking than back thinking?
What they need to do, and hopefully that's what they are going to do, although we have got Daleks and possibly some bloke who once wore a famous goatee,
mm-hmm.
and some silver people. Other than those, what it really needs to do in the next series is go back to series one, where everything is completely new.
Do you think that's going to happen though?
I think it might edge more towards series one in some kind of tone-esque way, but no, I don't think that's what's going to happen. I hope it is. It really needs to be. Even series, the second half of series six, if you take away all the arc stuff, there's a lot of good standalone episodes in there.
Mm.
You know, like Girl Who Waited and The God Complex. They don't rely on any big kind of ongoing stories.
I don't want to blow your point there, but I think you've only named the only two out of that.
Yeah. Probably, yeah. But
they were very good.
Yeah, but if we go back to series five as well, there's a lot of standalones in there as well, such as Vincent and the Doctor. And
I think it's nice. I think it's nice to make reference to the past. I think the mistake that they make, and maybe the mistake that J&T made, was that he wasn't referencing; he was revisiting.
Well, I don't think we should be blaming J&T. I think because it didn't happen under Bidmead, and it didn't happen that much under Cartmel either. The person to blame,
Eric,
is Eric Soward. Yeah,
yeah. Mm. But I mean, But that's the point. Whoever you want to blame in that era, maybe that is the problem. Is that they shouldn't be. Shouldn't be trying. I mean, certainly I don't think there's been any. I mean, we've said this before, and again, I'm cautious and tentative that we're too negative, but it seems the Moffat era has been a horrendously big one for making retroactive changes to continuity.
Yeah.
And that is perhaps something that the show shouldn't be trying to do. It shouldn't need to do. In fact, he puts his own buffer in, doesn't he? Like at the Big Bang, where everything's technically rewritten. So mm-hmm. he's got another time war buffer to the continuity. So in a sort of sense, surely you should be moving forward, not trying to fiddle with the things in the background, because you're almost just saying that stuff doesn't matter. But
yeah. But you know, at the same time, what has Stephen Moffat done to Doctor Who, as well as these kind of looking back things? He's created the Silence, he's created the Vashta Narada, he's created the Clockwork Droids, and he wrote The Girl in the Fireplace. He created the Weeping Angels. He's done these all these stunningly amazing things at the same time as baffling our heads this afternoon in these things that he's done, which are quite clearly to us as fans like him, things that he probably shouldn't have done, because they're a little bit echoing towards what happened 30 years ago when Doctor Who got itself into a bit of a pickle.
Yeah, well, that is the problem, is it? The more you revisit stuff, the more you sort of stir it up. It becomes like this. I mean, this is the whole problem with the issue of the numbering of the Doctors. If he hadn't meddled, and I use that word again, a very negative word, if he hadn't gone that down that route,
if he hadn't massaged,
yes, if he hadn't massaged the history, sir,
if he hadn't massaged the Doctor,
he wouldn't have all these ripples. Really, I know we're throwing metaphors to the wind here, but
close to double entendre. I don't know about metaphors.
Yeah, maybe, but yes, if he hadn't caused these ripples, he wouldn't be having to deal with them and having to comment on them.
Yeah, yeah,
and yeah, that. At the same time, I still think the Hurt, I know we've talked about this before, I still think the Hurt Doctor sort of worked. It would have been better with Eccleston, I think, thinking about it. But without Eccleston, it was quite a nice idea to have an extra Doctor that year.
It was definitely a fun idea, and it did work. It just, it was backpedaling, and it was what caused the issue that most people are complaining about. But I think the interesting thing and the telling thing is that you talk to anyone, their big complaint is just that he wants to try and renumber the Doctors and complain about it, whereas nobody's complaining about not liking the War Doctor. Everybody actually seems to like him and the idea of him.
Indeed. Okay, let's move on. I suspect we'll be... this is a topic that might come up again in the future, but nevertheless, we will push on. Philip Morris has broken his silence. And I'll say Philip Morris has broken his silence. This isn't like... He hasn't been a hermit. He hasn't been hiding away. He's just been busy working. And he held a Facebook Q&A last week. I think it was Monday last week, actually, while we were doing this, or while I was editing last week's podcast. And he is not saying that there are any new episodes. What he is saying is that there are no announcements in the pipeline at the present. It can sometimes be the wrong thing with ongoing work and investigation. This is the nice bit, though, is that he's optimistic. He says that the wind is blowing the right way. And he's quite clear that it is a dangerous business, finding these TV episodes from around the world.
Yeah, I was surprised by that in the comments. I didn't realise quite how intense it was.
Yeah. During the last announcement, he says, I was in a very hostile part of the world, which will explain why he wasn't at the screening. We sent Gareth to it. We didn't send him. He was going anyway. I was in a very hostile part of the world, and suddenly I was everywhere on TV. Actually, we did send him. My anonymity was compromised, which made the team a target. So we must plan these things carefully for the greater good of the project and the safety of the personnel involved. Those, bombs going off and things like that. It is pretty scary, and, we don't... It was in Syria. There was an occasion in Africa, I think, with a bomb as well. It's good news to hear from him. And I think, is it safe to say that he would have basically not said anything if there was nothing out there? He was just gone away, gone back to whatever he was doing, because he is finding other shows as well as Doctor Who, which is something many Doctor Who fans kind of forget.
I think his own comments basically about, the wind is blowing in the right direction kind of says what we need to know. There is stuff to be found, or he is finding things. It's just, be patient. I also think it's probably something that should have been said sooner. If the situation that he's in being a dangerous situation, it probably would have put at least a few of us.
I think there was some talk of it early on, but I don't think it was underlined enough.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, they really should have made a bigger point of it. Like what most people are complaining about out there is the secrecy of it all. And you take anything that should be what is perceived anyway to be public knowledge, and you put some secrecy on it, and people are going to get upset. But if you can at least spell it out to them in particular reasons why it needs to be secret for now, at least people would have a better understanding that, yeah, there's good news possibly in the pipeline. We have to wait for it. We have to be patient for it. But we also don't want to ruin those chances. Certainly don't want to put anybody's lives at stake for it.
James?
I find it weird that line where he says that it sort of compromised the safety of his team because of his name, his face became visible. It just, if we take that as fact, it just shows how little I understand the situations in those sort of areas. And because to me, even if people did know his face, what difference does it make? Would that, how would, I still can't imagine him being a relevant target in any sort of political, social warfare that's going on. But that's not to say I'm not saying that he isn't. I'm just saying I'd have never imagined it, which just shows how little I understand the circumstances in that sort of area of the world. And it's quite terrifying.
Yeah, you're in great.
Yeah, I think. I think it's actually just more so kind of you can put someone in another country that, you know, obviously is not native to that country, and they can look at them and say, hey, you know, we can take these people as potential hostages for our situations. But you take somebody and that you see their face in the news in any kind of capacity, then it makes you think that they are somewhat in some way a little bit more important than just some tourist that's there that you've captured. You know, it's a little bit more of a bargaining chip, at least in their mind. It may not be some big political leader, but I understand the rationale behind it. I understand that they're going to look at that and say, wow, okay, so this guy must be somebody. So let's start with him.
Yeah, we don't want to get too much into this, but there's a lot of travel involved. There's a lot of going to remote places. When I say remote places, I mean remote places within the countries you're going to, and countries that are kind of going through upheaval, such as Syria. So, I mean, that's dangerous enough. I think that will put most of us off. Well, all we can say, really, on this matter is best wishes to Philip and his team, and fingers crossed that they find something that hasn't already been rumoured. Well, I don't want to get into the whole Omni rumour thing, but let's just hope that they find something good for us. And for whoever, actually, not just for Doctor Who fans, just finding retro TV, what am I talking about? Finding classic TV and movies is clearly a difficult job.
That's what I mean. That's why I find it so amazing. Because I kind of imagined it to be totally bureaucratic. That you would go down, you know, there would be wars in these countries, but you'd just be going down to offices, dealing in meetings and going back home, you know, and it all being paperwork and on the phone stuff. I never imagined it being so hands-on and so threatening, so oppressive like that. So it's opened my eyes a bit.
Okay. Russell T. Davies' damaged goods adapted for Big Finish. Now, this is news, as you've probably guessed by now. The Big Finish are adapting a Russell T. Davies 1996 Virgin New Adventures 7th Doctor story called Damaged Goods. This is this is one of the later novels from Virgin, just around the time when the range was transitioning back to the BBC following the mixed success of the TV movie starring Paul McGann. It's hot on the heels of Love and War being adapted, which was a Seventh Daughter Ace and Benny novel. That's been adapted. And there's also there's a couple of Fourth Daughter and Romana stories. Well, there's one that's been done so far, and there's another one being announced, The Well-Mannered War, both by Gareth Roberts. And The Well-Mannered War is going to be available at the same time as Damaged Goods. Russell T. Davies on Big Finish. This is really exciting. And we can't really say much more about it than that. We'll stay clear of anything else we've heard, gentlemen, on this particular topic. But Brian, you're a big Finish fan. Yeah. Now, this was a controversial book at the time. There was reports in the press about this book. Because there's some adult moments in it. How do you think that's going to translate? Jonathan Morris is in the adaptation. Do you think they'll tone that down?
Well, I don't know. It really depends on how well you can portray those sorts of things on audio, I think, is what it comes down to. I don't think they're quite concerned about the controversy, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's my take on
nearly
it.
Nearly 20 years later as well, so sure, well, times have changed.
They toned down Love and War, so I would be surprised if it is, yeah, a little bit. Certainly the language and some of the detail.
Yeah, not surprised by that so much, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what they're going to do or how they're going to treat it, but I can say it's interesting news because it's Russell T. Davies, and here it's going to be in the hands of Big Finish, which is interesting in itself. But as you guys know how I feel about the books, we've talked about it before.
Yes.
And just, I guess, you know, just for those who may, this may be your first podcast, real quick, it's just I never really quite felt they captured the essence of the show or the characters for me. It will be interesting to hear this adaptation with the actual actors in place and see if maybe it somehow works better to me than it would have in book form.
At the same time, how did you feel about Love and War again? I know we've talked about this before, but you quite liked that adaptation.
Yeah, but you know, I hadn't read the book.
Yeah.
And I remembered thinking Love and War was a good story. To this, right now, as we talk about it now, I remember nothing about it. You know, honestly, thinking about it, I really don't. But I remember thinking it worked well. But I think I think part of that is I had gotten used to Benny and so on in the Big Finish play. Mm-hmm. So hearing her more or hearing her in the story had me already used to the character a little bit more. But I don't know. I never read the book, so I never really had a basis for comparison.
Well, you see, that's my point, is that I do think what Big Finish has done quite well with that, and I think what they'll probably do with this, is that they'll be adapting it so it fits the tone of Big Finish, which is, and I don't mean this in any rude way, less adventurous as the Virgin books were trying. They were really pushing every envelope they could. Big Finish seems to sit a little more on a balance between what the show's about, what has been about, to trying to find new things to do with it. So I think it'll probably fit more in tandem with Big Finish. And I think that's the best way to do it. I think it should. I think the other problem is that I think one of the reasons Love and War probably doesn't stick in your mind as much is that Love and War came out as a book long before the sort of wave of Big Finish came out, where Doctor Who has changed through things like Big Finish and the new series. It is a sort of more contemporary sci-fi narrative approach to writing than the old classic series was, obviously. But the Virgin was the first ones to start doing that. So I think by the time Big Finish has done 10 odd years, you kind of listen to Love and War and it doesn't seem quite as mind-blowing, because Big Finish has been doing that same sort of quality and that same sort of intensity of dark sci-fi. It's a bit like the Beatles, isn't it? You know, the Beatles at the time were mind-blowing, but now if you put the Beatles on to a kid, they'll go, yeah, it sounds a bit like Oasis to me. Who's Oasis? And, you know, I think that's the problem with it. And it was great in its time, but listening to it myself, I found it wasn't as mind-blowing as it was for me when I first read it, because it was just so much darker and serious and thoughtful than the classic show was ever really allowed to be.
Mm.
So I think that's the problem Love and War had, and I'll be interested to see how Damaged Goods goes in the same way.
Yeah, Russell seems very pleased. He says, "I've always been a huge fan of Big Finish."
Now we get the Scottish accent.
Since long before I took the big chair on Doctor Who, and so long after. So when they asked if they could adapt Damaged Goods, well, to be honest, I asked them what took so long.
I can imagine him doing that as well.
The story features a family called the Tylers.
Yeah.
Which is not so interesting, but it is a name. And Russell T. Davies is famous for reusing names throughout his different works. I recall he said that it helps him get a handle on the character very quickly. You can see how that might work. Another thing about Damaged Goods is that it only features Sylvester McCoy. He's the only recognisable element. There's going to be some recasting here, or some new casting. There's new characters, Chris Quedge and Ross Forrester, who were adjudicators from the future. I think they were from the Frontier in Space era?
Yeah, they were.
I think they were, yeah. So that'll be quite interesting. We'll be getting some new companions cast.
Yes, I agree. When I first read Chris and Ross, I was never particularly certain, but as they went along, I quite enjoyed them.
I wasn't that keen on her, but I found I didn't mind him at first, but I found him a bit wet later on, and I found her a lot more interesting.
He was a bit wet, wasn't he? Wasn't certain. I suppose I didn't mind it so much because he was he wasn't a weedy character. He was, you know, quite a strong, burly policeman. Yeah. But he was very soft.
Yeah.
And somehow I found that quite surprising. I think it was also interesting. I know in the New Adventures we'd had Benny as well, who was from the future. But to have two people who were so firmly from the future in a way that Benny wasn't. I mean, Benny, you know, very much obviously felt like a certain sort of like Liz Hurley sort of actresses of our time. It was based on that sort of 90s female who was into drinking and, you know, lots of... massive fan of 20th century, so yes, she had the sex and she had the loads of contemporary references for us to enjoy and the likes. So she was very much rooted in us, but Chris and Roz weren't. They were very much from the future, and that made it quite interesting to have those two being so distant and disconnected from
things. Having a companion like that, you know, you've got the Benny thing that you just explained there, and you can kind of, it's kind of comfortable, isn't it, that with that knowledge of 20th and 21st century and all those little amusing little confusions that might occur in a kind of like the chap in The Voyage of the Damned.
Mr. Yes.
Popper, that kind of. But then when you've got characters like the Adjudicators, you can use that And it works so well on telly just to underline how ridiculous our world is at the moment.
Yeah, and it's worked in the TV show when they did it. I mean, I think Adric had a bit of that, obviously. Mm. Romana, Leela is probably the best example.
Yeah.
Zoe, and even Jamie to a degree on the other end of the scale, which was very rare for Doctor Who. And I'm surprised they've not really done that again.
Yeah.
Well, they were possibly going to do it with Clara at one point. Well, maybe, it would have been more interesting. Yeah.
Okay, so that's Russell T Davies on Big Finish. Wouldn't it be nice, as I said at the end of the article, if the BBC could say yes to some later Doctors on Big Finish as well. If only. Okay, we will press on, lady and gentlemen. We're doing a favour now. We're doing a favour for Gareth Kavanagh. Okay. You may know him, dear listener, as the editor of the amazing Warp Warp Doctor Who fanzine. He's also a friend of the podcast. He's been on the podcast more than any other person other than us three. And he's in the middle at the moment of producing an adaptation of Othello. Now, you may know or you may not, but I will tell you, he used to run a pub in Manchester up until about 12 months ago. And that pub used to have Doctor Who conventions in there. He would do live shows of, he'd have comedy nights as well. And he'd do live performances of things like With Nell and I, Coronation Street 1977 with scripts by Jack Rosenthal, who was the husband of Maureen Lipman. There's a Doctor Who link for you. And even Russell T Davies' Midnight, starring a chap not called the Doctor. Othello is another production that he's doing along the similar sort of lines, using his Last Productions company. He's outside of the pub because he doesn't have the pub anymore, so he's taking it to some other location. The idea is Shakespeare's Othello, set in Venezia FC, a football club. Is there a better setting to explore jealousy, lust and reputation in 2014? So he's bringing it all up to date and setting it in a football club, which to me sounds like genius. As the strapline says, it's Shakespeare in a football club staged in one of Europe's greatest football citadels, Manchester. It excites us as an idea and we're sure audiences will agree. There is a trailer on the Castoris website because there is a Kickstarter attached to it. I think it's to help cover the cost of the production. They're looking to raise £895. And they're doing quite well at the moment. But it does close next Monday. If you are able to contribute, this is a Kickstarter, so there's lots of lovely artwork available by Colin Brockhurst, who was the designer on Warp Warp issues 1 and 2 and the current Warp Warp 3, which is in production. So there is a very good opportunity to get some really cool stuff. And this, if this doesn't win awards, and, you know, they've won awards for some of the previous productions, then I will be extremely surprised. And I am planning on going to see it. So the link is in the show notes there. What do you think of this idea?
It's a good idea.
It is, isn't it? I think it's almost revolutionary. Because a lot of the time, often bringing Shakespeare up to date doesn't quite work. It has worked more. I think in recent times it's worked better than it did in the past. But certainly, you know, it's always been a bit of a difficult thing for people to manage to bring up to date in the right manner. Brian, thoughts?
Yeah, I'm interested in seeing it. I always like when people can take something that we are used to and kind of turn it on its head a little bit and give us something new. So I'm interested to see how it plays out. I don't quite get the setting quite as much, not having lived in the UK to know that setting quite as well as you guys, but I think it sounds like an interesting idea.
It is. It's a really interesting idea.
I think what I like about it is that it has a double connection of taking, you know, Manchester obviously having a very strong football theme as well, so it grounds the idea within Manchester, within the whole idea of taking Othello into such a quite relevant contemporary setting. So it works like three levels. I think that's pretty cool. And the Kickstarter money isn't that much, really.
No, it's not very low for some of the things I've seen.
So it's quite manageable if people want to sort of give them a hand. I think that's they're not asking for a great deal.
Absolutely. All right. All the best with that, Gareth. I think I just heard him reply then. Okay. We're going to move on to our last item, then we'll be checking out. Oh, no, hold on. No, we're not. We're not. We're not doing that now. No, we won't do that now. We're going to move on to our penultimate item.
Right.
Which is the last thing that I put in the show notes, chaps. This is just come along today, which is why I forgot, dear listener. Verity Lambert has been Well, she hasn't been given a blue plaque. A blue plaque dedicated to godmother of Doctor Who, Verity Lambert, has been installed at Riverside Studios in London. This is amazing news, but hey, how has it taken so long?
Taken what? 50 years?
Well, yeah. Well, the best part of 50 years.
Best part of 50 years, yeah.
Yeah. No, this took place last Wednesday. I don't know how we overlooked this. I didn't receive anything about it. I didn't see anything in the press about it until yesterday. I spotted it on the Doctor Who News site. So, hello, Doctor Who News. And Warwick Sussain was on hand to unveil the plaque. He wasn't the only one. As I recall, I think William Russell was there as well. Warwick Sussain recalls that he met Verity in a small room at Television Centre when we were both very young. Little did we know that this would be a jumping off point for a programme which is not only alive today, but huge. You should know, dear listener, that Verity Lambert was the producer charged with bringing Doctor Who to the air. She only stayed for a year, and then she moved on and eventually formed her own company, Cinema Verity, which did an awful lot of shows that we probably know, dear listener. Can you throw one at me? Well, there's El Dorado. Wasn't the was Campion Cinema Verity?
I'm not sure Campion was it?
I'm not sure. That's why I asked you.
I would have said no, it wasn't.
Okay.
But
well, there's a lot of things that were. You're looking it up now for me, aren't you?
Yes, I am. No, Campion wasn't.
Okay, well, Jonathan Creek was.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's loads of stuff.
And there's loads of... Loads.
Minder was one, wasn't it?
Minder, of course, Minder,
Springs.
Yes.
To my mind, just having a look at her list now, in case people are interested in the stuff that she's done. I didn't know that she'd done. She was part. She was Clockwise.
Yes,
that's interesting.
Yes. Oh, I'm seen that for a while.
GBH, that was a very good series.
GBH, yeah, with Michael Palin. Yeah.
Michael Palin, yeah, that was Robert Lindsay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she had a massive list of stuff that you'll have heard of, and a fair few stuff you probably wouldn't have, but. For Adamant Lives, of course, which she went straight on to do.
Yeah.
I think it's quite important.
Yeah.
Quatermass, one of the later ones.
Is that
the
John Mills one?
Yeah. More on From Outer Space, oh dear.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was Dan Smith, wasn't it? And Griffith Jones.
Okay. Yeah. So, it's a bit late in the day for this, I think, but she won't have known. So, here's a lovely thing that which I've quoted from the article. Verity, speaking a few years ago, said about Doctor Who, I never made it for kids. I made it for the kid in me, and there had to be good stories which involved me. And that's the secret of anything, really.
I think that's true. I mean, I might have said this before, but when with Batman, the animated series, with Bruce Timm's one, when he was interviewed about it, and they said, you know, wasn't that quite adult? And he would say, no. He says, I wrote it for me as a 10-year-old who was actually quite intelligent. And the inference obviously being that people who write for children's stuff dumb down stuff. They don't think of what they would have wanted as kids. And I think Verity's point is probably why Doctor Who carries a slight adult theme, even in its very early days, because it was written because 10, 11-year-olds are on the verge of being adults. When I went to secondary school, I felt like an adult. I didn't feel like a child. So I think it's a very good approach to writing stuff.
I've said that for years too myself. Like whenever they would try and appeal to children by putting a child in a movie, in some sort of action movie or sci-fi thing. Yeah, I hate it too. Like that's the one we're supposed to relate to. I always bring up Temple of Doom with Short Round. Now Short Round was a cool character. They made him very funny and fun, but he's not the person when I was watching the movie that I wanted to be. I wanted to be Indiana Jones. When I watched
exactly,
Doctor Who, I was always the Doctor. You know, I wasn't Adric or any of the younger companions or any of the companions. You know, never even Jamie. You know, it was just, you know, I never liked that mentality of dumbing things down for children or trying to relate to children in some way. They're not as unintelligent as people give them credit for. And in fact, they're very highly intelligent. I look at my niece and my nephew and all the things that they can do with technology that took us years to learn. You know, like they get it. They understand it. And even the way my nephew talks about superheroes and all the cartoons he's watching, he doesn't sit there and think like Robin's the coolest or that some kid in the story is the coolest. He gets the bad guys. He gets the situations. It's very intelligent. It's very interesting to watch.
Indeed. We will move on now to Peter Capaldi, who has appeared in a four-page feature in the Sunday Times magazine yesterday. It's been causing some twirlings of interest among Doctor Who fans for obvious reasons. He's in costume. He actually puts the costume on for the interviewer.
Okay.
probably in a pre-arranged kind of thing. I don't think he... It doesn't seem as though he's just stripped off.
It was there.
It's not like... I mean, there appeared to be in some sort of studio-y workshop kind of place. It didn't take place at Peter Capaldi's house, and he sort of runs upstairs to put it on. How wonderful would that be?
You're still thinking about that, aren't you?
It's funny, isn't it?
I was sort of thinking of it being like he has his normal jeans and jumper on, and when they sit down, he stands up, and it's got that sort of Velcro, and he just tears it off, and it's underneath. And he does that wherever he goes. He goes to the shops, he does that as well, and he gets to the cashier's desk, and
I was thinking a little bit more like Mr. Rogers. Did you guys get Mr. Rogers?
We didn't. I know the reference.
But... Oh, it was the best. He walks in, you know, he's having a whole conversation. Well, you know, I can see him talking to the interviewers the entire time while he takes his shoes off, puts his slippers on, you know. But in this case, takes his slippers off, puts on his boots, you know, takes his sweater off, puts on his coat. I think that would be nice. I think that would be a great way to do an interview. Just throw off the interviewer. I think that would be hilarious.
Okay.
Anyway, that was my childhood. What's that?
Not for the interviewer, it wouldn't be hilarious.
No, that's why it would be hilarious to me.
there's a few... I mean, he talks about his doctor slightly. There'll be no flirting, that's for sure, he says. It's not what this doctor's concerned with. It's quite a fun relationship, but no, I did call and say, I want no Papa Nicole moments. I think there was a bit of tension with that at first, but I was absolutely adamant. What will he be like? He's also joyful, says Capaldi. One thing the show does well is balance the epic and the domestic. You can go from the edge of the universe to a pedestrian precinct. The Doctor loves watching stars being born in Andromeda. He's also thrilled to see litter blown across the supermarket car park at dawn. So, some encouraging things there, I think. He says he's based his mad-eyed, fierce, joyful litter watcher on a large selection of people.
Hmm. And who would they be? Would they be?
He's not saying.
Matt Smith,
I won't name names.
David Tennant. Christopher Eccleston.
People to spot them. I have a book, though. I started to collect images and quotes from people I thought were Doctor Who-ish. They might have a turn of phrase or a certain look that works, so I brought these things together. I bet he's had that book a very long time. Way beyond his casting.
Oh, no, I think it's good. I think it's cool when you get people who were such genuine fans to get the opportunity. I think more so when it's... And again, if we sort of do a callback to the earlier topic, I think it's better when it's people who are not in a capacity of control, per se. I think when it's people like David Tennant or Peter Capaldi who get to play something that as a kid they'd have adored, I think that's better. I think when it's a showrunner, even with Russell T. Davis, I suppose I was not just trying to pick on Moffat here, it becomes harder because their fandom could infect the show to a degree where I don't think an actor's can as much, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I like the fact, though, like for me, with him having these show notes and having his opinions on how the Doctor should be, and not only just the Doctor, but the show. I think that's a very good thing. It does bring me back to David Tennant a little bit, since he was a fan, and we do know that there were stories from back in the day where he would not go head-to-head so much as question kind of, would this be right, or even just telling them outright, I don't think this is what the Doctor would do or what the companion should do. And I like that sort of thing when somebody can challenge them. It's always good because when you challenge the writers, generally you're going to get something better, especially if you can justify your points and they seem valid to the show writers and showrunners. So I like that. I like that he's coming in with these kind of thoughts.
Leonard Nimoy, I used to say one of the reasons that he used to do it because he felt that, you know, with any series, there is a high turnover of people who aren't going to be quite as in tune. You know, you'll have different directors, you will have different writers. You are the one constant that should know that character so well that you can actually call out and say, wait a second, I know my character wouldn't say this because I play him every week. Well, you might do one or two of these in 4 years. So I think in that sense, it can be pretty good as well.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a great thing. I mean, and that's something like when he got cast, that's one of the first things that I said, but that he was a fan, that I was excited that somebody might actually, you know, give Moff a run for his money, you know, give him a little bit of, hey, maybe that doesn't make quite so much sense. Why don't we try it this way? You know, and I like that because I think I agree with you that Russell did it as well. And one thing with Russell, though, as I've always said, he's had Julie Gardner above him to kind of question certain things that didn't work. And by and mm-hmm. large, she did a good job with that. And he listened. With Moffat, he doesn't have anybody. So having an actor like that will challenge it. And, you know, he has a lot at stake. You know, he's got his reputation. He's got his the fact that he is a seasoned actor, and he's got the fact that he loves the show too, you know, and he wants to protect it just as much. I like that, and I think that will hopefully bring about good things.
Capaldi says, which we'll back you up on here, I didn't want to be Doctor Who in a Doctor Who I didn't like. I had to be convinced the show was going in a direction I was interested in. I had to think carefully about the level of visibility. My life was blessed, but as soon as this happened, I had paparazzi outside my house. People spoke to me before and recognised me, but nothing like this. I had to decide that if I was ready to live with that, because once that genie's out of the bottle, it doesn't go back in.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Mm. It's very sensible. It's the sound mind of a seasoned actor there, I think.
Well, that's... And this. Hey, you'll like this bit as well, then. He was out of work for a year before he became Malcolm Tucker in 2005. And the to the extent that he had a defaulting mortgage on the immediate horizon, it says here. And they were kept afloat only by his wife, who's a producer. Amazing the career of an actor, isn't it? Because it's not, you know, in 2005, that's probably around the time he was in Midsummer Murders, probably the year before or the year after. And then he goes straight into Malcolm Tucker when The Thick of It kicks off in 2005. It's weird how the whole world works for actors.
It's a scary world, I think.
Yeah.
Very,
it's quite. I mean, it's quite scary for us, I should think, as freelancers.
Yeah.
Not so much for Brighton.
Well, it is. I mean, I was saying this to
working
my sister.
Working for the man, but yeah.
That's right.
I was saying this to my sister the other day. Is what people don't seem to realise is that they think, well, it's, you know, such a cool life. You can work when you want, how you want, but then you never really ever clock off because you're always hoping or looking for that next job or.
Yeah.
And it's a stress like that. You never get the opportunity to come home and just go, I'm done. It's very you have to do it, but it's very hard to do because you're always thinking, well, my next job might disappear, or the job that I've got planned. One of the ones I've freelanced for 2-3 years now, they've pretty much just gone, dropped me. And you know, that's hard. You don't have any, you know, severance pay or anything. You're just a freelancer. So yeah, I can see why. I can see it happening to even the best.
Yeah. Well, there's we'll wrap up our Capaldi chat now. Other than saying, if you're interested in the article, I'm not going to risk copying it in any kind of great detail yet, but I'm going to be quoting from it on Castrobus later today, so that'll be in the show notes. And there's also a photo from it of Capaldi in an extremely bit pertry, bit tenant, very Capaldi pose on the Castrobus Instagram page. And now, dear listener, it's recommendations time. If you are new to the podcast, it's worth mentioning that the recommendations is the section where we give you something that we've been enjoying in the past week, which has some very, very threadbare link to Doctor Who. You know, it might be something that exists in the same universe that we live in, or it might be very, very closely to Doctor Who. It might actually be Doctor Who. And... While I'm giving you this public service announcement, it's probably also worth mentioning that if you're listening to us on iTunes, if you can give us a review and a rating, that would help us immeasurably. So, who's going first with the recommendations this week?
Go on, I was just going to say I'm game if you like.
Go for it.
All right, first thing I want to do is, before I do the recommendation, I want to give one more Casterbridge shout-out to Kelvin Sang, who contacted me not long ago after one of our other podcasts, just actually over the weekend, to let me know that what he listened to the one podcast we talked about where I had made the comment that everybody should check out the Children in Need special and we should kind of spread the word about that for the 2005 David Tennant poster generation scene,
mm-hmm.
and how it wasn't on the Internet Movie Database, so that, you know, some people don't know it's an extra on the DVDs. Some people watch on Netflix and don't even know that it's an option. And some people check Internet Movie Database and think they've checked everything there is to watch off their list. So Kelvin went ahead and heard me say that there wasn't a page for it on IMDb, and he went ahead and created one for it. So I wanted to say thank you for that. Cool. This way there are plenty of people who can go ahead and now find this short, which I certainly, as I said before, I feel is very important. So thank you, Kelvin.
Thank you, Kelvin.
Yeah, very cool, right? I thought that was very nice. Aside from that, my recommendation this week is I'm watching currently The War Games, which is Pat Troughton's final story as the Doctor during his own era. And it's beautiful. I love this story. I don't know. I have a very soft spot for this story. It's 10 parts. Some people seem to think it's long. I never feel the length.
No,
I
just
enjoy every minute of it.
As you actually said to the Bishop.
Hey.
I think that recommendation's really working, because I think I'm going to go and watch it this week.
Oh, nice. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on episode 5 myself now, so I'm actually looking forward to getting through work, coming home, and enjoying the rest of it.
Cool. Okay. Do you have another recommendation?
No, that's me today. Okay. I'm just going to do that one.
James, would you like to do yours, or shall I do mine?
You can do yours.
Okay, mine is possibly slightly controversial, but it does have a Doctor Who link. It's not the greatest superhero movie, but I watched Thor 2 last week, and I really enjoyed it. Doctor Who link, Greenwich. Although, this obviously takes us back to a particular Doctor Who story, Dimensions in Time, which we probably don't want to talk about. But there's an excellent action sequence. I mean, there's a lot of UK stuff in Thor 2. So that alone is worth seeing, how they've brought the whole superhero god thing into the UK. They've done a really good job with that. It's not as good as the first Thor film. It's probably, I would argue, it's the weakest of that stable of Marvel films. Probably. Would either of you disagree with me there?
Yeah, well, I kind of feel that way about the Thor films in general, to be honest.
I thought the first one was good, and I thought bringing him into the Avengers was good as well. But I just think that film, I don't want to go into this, I don't want to get snobby with actors, but I sometimes feel with Thor that casting a bloke from Home and Away as the brother of Tom Hiddleston, I mean, he acts him off the screen every time, doesn't he? Hiddleston's fantastic as Loki. And I just wonder if the chap whose name completely, Chris Hemsworth, is maybe not. I think he's fine as Thor. I just don't think he's... But as I say, I think it's the weakest of that stable, you know, that whole area of the Marvel comic book adaptations with Avengers and Iron Man and Captain America. And it's still an enjoyable film. I mean, you know, like 20 years ago, you wouldn't have got a comic book movie adaptation as cool as that. So I think it's a DVD. It's not, you know, I mean, if you missed it at the cinema, now's the time to watch it. I wouldn't have paid to go to the cinema and watch it, but, you know, DVD, fine. So that's my recommendation. Any thoughts on that, chaps?
Pretty much like I said, I'm not as keen on the Thor films as I am the other films. I'm not saying they're bad. I did enjoy them, and I certainly really like the character Thor. I really liked him in the Avengers. I thought he was great. But watching the Thor films, I never really just thought they were as good as the rest. I still enjoy them. But since you won't seem to mention him by name, I will. Christopher Eccleston, I thought, was really great.
He was good in it, actually. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, and I honestly, yeah, right? There's your Doctor Who link, Greenwich. At first it was a little weird to me that they had him like speaking a completely, entirely different language, especially
really
since
cool,
I thought it was neat. It was really well done, but I honestly thought it might have been something that would have turned him off as an actor, and I don't know why. I really don't know why I thought that, but when I saw it, I was like, wow, that's really cool. And the makeup effect on him was amazing. It looked really, really good on him.
Well, maybe what they'll do is in the third Thor film, maybe they'll have a brief shot of him, which is made completely of CGI, as in The Day of the Doctor and the second G.I. Joe film, just to create a trilogy of CGI Christopher Ecclestons who aren't in the latest release, as it were.
There you go.
Well, I mean, I've only watched the first Thor film, and I haven't seen the Avengers yet, and I wasn't enamoured at all by it, so... I don't think I will be making the effort.
If you stumble upon it on ITV2 in 5 years' time, watch it. But don't go out of your way to watch it.
No, well, that sounds fair enough. Well, I've got an interesting recommendation. I think it's interesting. Other people won't. So it probably isn't very, 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 very interesting at all. I'm not on the ball today. I don't feel on the ball. I feel like I've been drugged. I feel like before we came on air, someone's trank darted me. And I don't know. I just don't feel on form. This is, do you remember about a year ago, we did that one on Red Dwarf openings that were done for Doctor Who? If people know Red Dwarf openings, intros normally did a montage of clips done quite well in time to the music. And there was a few people on YouTube did versions of that using Doctor Who. So it would be the Red Dwarf music, Red Dwarf sort of style opening, but with Doctor Who as the key focus. And we put a few links up on the podcast. I've been watching a lot of Space 1999 of late. And people may remember it had the first series had a very iconic opening, which did this episode montage as part of its opening sequence, which Ron Moore for Battlestar Galactica copied because he liked it so much. I found a couple who have done the same for Doctor Who, using the same music and again that same format, and I've been really enjoying them. There's been a couple of very good ones. I'm going to just, because you poor guys are not really prepared for this.
Why aren't we?
Well, I was going to prepare and give you these, and I don't know, I just couldn't be bothered. Hold on. There's one. And this guy here, this guy, we'll shout a name, these will be in the show notes as usual. Katamix 2 is his name, and he's done slightly different variants for each season. And he's done various episodes within that season. So the one I've just shared out to the boys and girls of the podcast here is from series 4. And mine's Frozen. I think it's, which one is it? Oh, yes, it's the Suntaran Stratagem, which I thought was a quite good one. Because if you watch this one, it actually makes the Suntaran Stratagem look really exciting, which, of course, it wasn't. And most trailers which are really good can do that. They make you want to watch something and you watch it and think, oh, actually, damn it, the trailer is better than the movie. And so I find these really fascinating. I think it's a mixture of how they montage, whether they get it in time. And this guy is very good at getting clips that just flow within the beat of the music and make the episodes look, the upcoming episode look really exciting. And that's the first one. And there's another guy who does them called, always done one called Editing Sith Lord. And the reason I chose this is that because the ones the last guy are all new series. This one did John Pertwee. And why that is interesting is, of course, it was the 70s, which Space 1999 was. So there is a sort of 70s feel to this version, which I really like. It does feel like if you did a John Pertwee Doctor Who using at the time Space 1999 as the template, it would look like this. Just to make things more confusing, he does actually use the more recent release of Day of the Daleks as part of the montage, so it has current CGI effects in there. But beyond that, they're really good, and I just think they're worth having a look at because they're fun, they're well put together, and they don't take long to watch. And if you're into editing and trailers and the like, I think they're quite fascinating little experiments. And the other link, of course, is Space 1999, which had Patrick Troughton, Brian Blessed, et al.
Many others, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's quite
and
cool.
And many others.
I'm just
I say, for the first guy, he does them for the most recent ones. He did Series 5, I think, which is probably the best out of the lot. His timing, the quality of the sound is really good. I chose that one because I thought the shot of Catherine Tate on the opening was just a great one to pick because it's just so cheeky. But again, you guys, as you listen to this, you're going to have to watch it to understand what I've been rattling on about for the last 5 minutes. They're fun, aren't they?
I'm trying to check them out on my phone as we're talking here, so sorry for the silence.
That's all right.
But yeah, I like that sort of thing.
Did you watch Space 1999, Brian? I mean,
I haven't watched much of it. As a matter of fact, my first time... over, well, I shouldn't say my first time, my second time to the UK, which is my first time actually visiting Christian and Anthony. Anthony actually was very keen on the show, so he had me watching a couple episodes while we were hanging out. But that was my first exposure to it. I haven't actually been able to pick it up because I haven't been able to find it over here. But it was interesting, the bits that I saw. However, I felt bad for Anthony because I was jet lagged completely. So the bits that I saw weren't much because I kept passing out.
It's a good show, and it's got a very nice sort of slow beat British feel to it, and yet it's got a little bit of that having the two American leads or three Morse was Canadian, I think, wasn't he? I'm not sure. Barry Morse. Yes, transatlantic leads. It gives it a slightly more dynamic feel to it, and it's very smartly put together, and definitely recommend it if people haven't watched it, especially the first series.
Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Casterbus podcast with a K. Dear listener, and I expect you'll be back next time. We hope you'll be back next time. James perhaps isn't that bothered, but I know that Brian is really looking forward to seeing you again. I think James is actually more interested in the lady over your shoulder, dear listener. But until then, it's goodbye. Mm.
Casterbus.com has to be my favorite website in the cosmos. Would you like a jelly, baby?